Welcome to this week's Talking History. My name is Brian LeBeau, Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. Looking back at this week, April 13 through 19 in history, on April 14, 1865, John Wilkes Booth shot President Abraham Lincoln in Washington's Ford Theater. 9 hours later, but on the 15th, the nation's 16th president was pronounced dead. Also on April 14th, but in 1912, the unsinkable Titanic slammed into an iceberg and began filling with water. 3 hours later, again on the 15th, the British luxury liner sank into the Atlantic, killing nearly 1,500 people. On April 17th, 1970, the nation breathed a sigh of relief when Apollo 13 splashed down into the Pacific after a problem-ridden voyage. And on April 18th, 1775, Paul Revere set out on horseback to warn the patriots of Massachusetts that the British were coming. The next day, April 19, 1775, the first shots of the Revolution were fired at the battles of Lexington and Concord. Turning to our weekly segment, History in the News, recent research by Boston University historian Robert Dalek has shed disturbing new light on the Johnson administration on the election of 1968. In his new book, Flawed Giant, Dalek discloses that President Johnson was so fearful of Vice President Humphrey's breaking with him over Vietnam that he ordered the FBI to wiretap Humphrey's phone and offices. Humphrey was a candidate in the presidential race and under great pressure to give up Vietnam. Johnson was not the only one wiretapping and spying his way through the 60s. The 132,000 recently released documents of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission reveal that the state's clandestine attempt to prevent racial integration and civil rights reform. The commission, formed in 1956 by the state legislature, was charged with, quote, protecting the sovereignty of the state of Mississippi from federal government interference. Instead, it wiretapped, spied, and harassed those who challenged separation of the races and white supremacy. And finally, while scholars continue to argue about how much President Nixon really knew about the illegal activities that precipitated his resignation, one fact is indisputable. He sure did complain a lot. With all of the archives that have been opened in recent years concerning the Nixon administration, historians are overwhelmed by the amount of nitpicking and bellyaching the president did. Whether it was an uncomfortable car ride, a disagreeable lunch, or a soft-headed aide, Nixon was sure to make a note about it. Because he disliked face-to-face encounters and preferred to communicate through writing, Nixon has left behind an abundance of such documentation, giving historians a revealing and sometimes humorous view into the personal side of this complex and irritable president. For our principal segment today, I'm pleased to welcome back Dennis Mihalik, fellow Creighton historian, who will talk to Lee Grinstead on the unsinkable Molly Brown. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. Our guest today is Lee Grinstead, director of the Molly Brown House Museum in Denver, Colorado. Today, she will enlighten us about the escapades of Margaret Tobin Brown, first immortalized by Meredith Willson on Broadway in the musical The Unsinkable Molly Brown, and who has recently been reintroduced to moviegoers by the blockbuster Hollywood hit Titanic. Welcome, Ms. Grinstead.
Thank you.
In researching this piece, I was surprised that Molly Brown has largely been ignored by historians. Could you give us a brief background on Margaret Tobin?
Sure. Margaret was born July 18, 1867 in Hannibal, Missouri, and she moved west in the 1880s and moved to Leadville, Colorado, which was a silver mining town at that time. She met and married her husband, James Joseph Brown, in Leadville in 1886, and they had two children. They moved to Denver in 1894 after J.J. had figured out a way to shore up the sides of the Little Johnny Mine with some bales of hay. They were having sand collapses and that sort of thing. They hit one of the widest veins of gold and high-grade copper ore ever found up until that point, and they moved to Denver after really striking it rich, if you will. And they lived in this house, which is the museum, from 1894, it continuously until 1912, and she, in fact, owned the house until her death in 1932.
Okay. Now, was hers a usual marriage and family?
I suppose as usual as anyone's. She married for love, and J.J. was 13 years older than she was. They had quite a bit in common, both first-generation Irish-Americans. They were both Catholic. They seemed to have quite a bit in common and were married in 1886 and remained married, stayed together through 1909. In 1909, they did actually go through a legal separation and never got back together, but they never divorced either.
Following a good Catholic practice.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, did she retain close relations with her children?
She had very close relations with her children, actually, throughout their lives or throughout her life. And she certainly was a very interested mother, some might say overbearing, but she was very concerned about their well-being and cared deeply for them. They did, as the children grew older, there seemed to be some communication problems between Helen, her daughter, and Molly, and they did not speak for a number of years, but I think they kept close tabs on one another. And as I said, she cared deeply for them, but they did sort of go separate ways.
Okay. Now, in doing research for this program, I ran across a reference that actually her first nickname was Irrepressible. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I've never heard that before. So you've come across a source that I haven't seen. But it's entirely possible. She was she had a very spunky personality, and I think people were beginning to nickname her very early on.
I guess it was a journalistic reference in terms of her widespread activity.
Mm-hmm. That could be.
So that I understand that she was engaged in feminist activity around the turn of the century and the early 20th century. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's some indication, it's likely, in fact, that she was active in the 1893 suffrage campaign for the suffrage campaign in Colorado. Colorado gave women the right to vote in the state in 1893, so it's likely that she was active in that campaign. She was certainly active in the Denver Women's Clubs in 1894 upon moving to Denver, and those were very active in terms of the kind of promotion of feminist ideals at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So even before the turn of the century, I think she was really involved.
I see. And then I understand that she was also somewhat of a progressive reformer, that is, the early 20th century progressive reform movement, and that she became interested in labor organizing?
She did. And by 1914, the Ludlow incident in Colorado, she was at that time staying in Newport, Rhode Island, and she was the president of a woman's organization who was sort of dedicated to improving condition of mine workers. She sent a telegram to Rockefeller at that point before the Ludlow massacre and stated that the conditions were deteriorating rapidly and that he needed to make some kind of change or there was going to be real serious trouble. As it turned out, there was a strike and there were a great number of problems. She left Newport at that point and came back. She telegrammed back to Denver and said to the women's groups that were here, I will support the striking miners workers and their wives. I will help financially. It will take me a few days to get there. please wait for me, and then came back to Denver and then on down to Trinidad. And the Ludlow massacre took place when women and children were put into a pit underneath a striking miner's tent, and the tents were on fire and women suffocated down below. They did not know that they were there. And so she was very active in helping to try and, I think, bring attention to the issue and to financially back and the miners and help them make conditions a little more suitable.
Mm-hmm. Her background is a rags-to-riches story, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Her background is rags-to-riches. She's sort of the American dream, I think, idealized American dream. But I don't think she ever lost her true roots, and she knew what it was like to work hard for a living and had a great deal of sympathy for people that were working in bad conditions and poor conditions and used her money as she could to try and improve those conditions.
Okay. Now, as you say, using her money, in the Denver area, is she known as a philanthropist?
She was absolutely a philanthropist. She was known for her generosity throughout. She was very involved in helping some of the museums that started here, very involved in the arts, the theater, historic preservation, actually. She was real active with Catholic charities, including some orphanages and the St. Mary's Academy, which was a school for girls that actually relocated in 1911 to just two doors away from her house here on this block on Pennsylvania Street. She was also supported the St. Vincent de Paul organization. She was the chairman of the St. Joseph's Charity Bazaar, which helped to raise money for the St. Joseph's Hospital, and in fundraising for the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception, which is the Catholic Basilica about two blocks from her house as well. So she was very generous with her time and her money.
Yes, and she sounds to be a person who was motivated by her religion and her spirituality.
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Did she have other civic crusades or interests?
She seemed to be very interested, especially in the 1920s. You read about her bringing pieces back to Denver, art pieces that she would pick up. She picked up a stuffed crocodile to bring back to the Museum of Natural History so that people in Denver that did not have the opportunities to travel to South America, as she did at that time, would have an opportunity to see what a crocodile looked like. And she was bringing statues back with her on the Titanic when it sunk, and those were intended for the art museum,
mm-hmm,
at that time. So
okay.
She was really interested in bringing that sort of thing to Denver.
Mm-hmm. So after acquiring wealth, she became a regular vacationer worldwide. Is that
mm-hmm.
it? Mm-hmm. And then how specifically did she come to be a passenger on the Titanic?
She was visiting she was traveling in Egypt, and she had gone back to France and received a telegram from her son saying that his son was ill with, I believe, a very rheumatic fever. And so she booked passage on the closest, you know, the fastest ship or the first ship that was leaving, and managed to get on board the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. So it was circumstances that put her on the Titanic, not that she had planned to be on the maiden voyage of this notable seagoing vessel then.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was sheer circumstance that put her on board that ship at that time.
Okay. And then, of course, as we know, Hollywood has just made this movie that is taking the world by storm.
Mm-hmm.
You have seen the movie?
Yes, I have. Yes. I went early
Good.
In December.
That will make my next question have more sense then. How would you evaluate her portrayal in the movie?
I think that Kathy Bates really did a wonderful job in portraying her warmth and her sense of humor, her sort of feminist spirit and her generosity. and her intelligence. I think she portrayed that very well. I think that the film unfortunately fell into the Hollywood trap of this myth of an uneducated woman or a socially uncomfortable woman, and they have a scene where women are don't want to have tea with her and they try to run away from her, or they have a scene where she's carrying in her own luggage, and it doesn't fit with the real woman. And in that, I think it's unfortunate. They also took quite possibly one of the largest liberties with her life when they have her sit down in the lifeboat and be quiet and not pull anyone in, not help or not rescue anyone. In fact, she really took charge of the lifeboat and told the man that was in charge of her lifeboat to calm down, sit down, or she would throw him overboard, not the reverse, as you see in the movie Titanic today. So that was sort
yes,
of unfortunate.
So she really received, journalistically, at the time, national acclaim as a heroine Titanic.
She did. And she used her skills. I think she was a great publicist and had great public relations and marketing skills. She used the opportunity to really speak her mind and use the press as a way to promote her own platform. She said at the time that she felt that it was ridiculous that men had stepped aside and let women and children go off on their own. She said they left these women and children with no way to support themselves, and that the woman should have stayed on the ship and gone down and not become a burden to society, not a particularly popular stand. And she also really railed on the management of the ship and blamed the captain and blamed Bruce Ismay particularly for going too quickly in ice-covered waters and felt very strongly about a number of issues and used her contact with the press and the ability to do the interview to promote that platform, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of her character, then, that is this unsinkable person.
Yes.
How do you think the Kathy Bates character portrays the personal characteristics of Margaret Tobin Brown?
I think she portrays the personal characteristics very well. I think that she portrays her intelligence and her warmth and her sense of humor well. I think her personal characteristics, the fact that she was actually seated at the captain's table would have been appropriate, that those sorts of things, I think, were very appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And physically, she's certainly the
good
typecast that anyone of anyone who has ever played Molly Brown.
I was going to conclude with that.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
At least historically, they chose a person that did look somewhat like a
yes.
Margaret Tobin Brown.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have. I've been talking with Lee Grinstead, director of the Molly Brown House Museum in Denver, Colorado.
Thank you, Dennis. Appropriately, we have chosen as this week's historic site the Molly Brown House Museum, where Lee Grinstead serves as director. The Molly Brown House was built in 1889 and purchased by the Brown family in 1894. Now open to the public as a museum, it has been restored to reflect the turn-of-the-century opulence in which the Browns and other wealthy Western families lived. For more information on the Molly Brown House, check its website at www.mollybrown.org. April 24th is Arbor Day, a national holiday with a 126-year history, set aside to remind us of our responsibility for the environment. For this week's op-ed piece, we've invited Gary Brenzo, Information Coordinator of the National Arbor Day Foundation, to give us his perspective on the holiday.
When he conceived of that first Arbor Day 126 years ago, J. Sterling Morton had this vision. Other holidays repose on the past. Arbor Day proposes for the future. Morton was to live out his vision. He and his new bride, Carolyn French Morton, came to Nebraska in 1854, drawn by the promised opportunity of the Nebraska Territory. For Morton himself, that interest had first been kindled by the stories of the region he had read as a young reporter for the Detroit Free Press. When he and Carolyn arrived in Nebraska City, Nebraska, after traveling by train, boat, and stagecoach, they began to settle the 160 acres of government land they had purchased there. They also promptly began to pursue many of their old interests in their new home. J. Sterling Morton resumed his journalistic career, serving as editor of the Nebraska Territory's only newspaper, the Nebraska City News, from 1856 to 1857. Although he was editor for just 1 year, he remained a journalist the rest of his life through editorials that promoted the causes he believed in, including the need to plant trees. He also pursued his own political plans. He served as Secretary of the Territory of Nebraska from 1858 to 1861, and as acting territorial governor from 1858 to 1859. And while he narrowly lost elections for several other posts, including the first governorship of the new state of Nebraska, he was to make many important contributions. From 1893 to 1897, he was President Grover Cleveland's Secretary of Agriculture, the highest government position he was to hold. Today, Morton is best remembered as the founder of Arbor Day. While he pursued his political career, he and Carolyn were also raising a family and working to turn their home and state into a lusher, greener place. By their example and by Morton's frequent editorials, they encouraged others to plant trees. Their greatest encouragement was to be the establishment of Arbor Day in April of 1872. On that first Arbor Day, more than 1 million trees were planted. National Arbor Day soon came to be observed on the last Friday in April. The rest, as they say, is history, but it is a living, evolving history with a message perhaps more important than it was 126 years ago. We can't overlook our responsibility to the natural world, and we must explore all opportunities for stewardship and conservation. Among those opportunities is renewed interest in planting trees and in the Tree Planters Holiday. Celebrated in the early part of this century with great fervor, Arbor Day is again enjoying a resurgence in popularity. The National Arbor Day Foundation, a nonprofit organization that helps people plant and care for trees, now includes 1 million members. The message of the Arbor Day Foundation and of Arbor Day itself is simple: plant trees. In that simplicity is the wisdom of the vision set forth by J. Sterling Morton over a century ago. Arbor Day proposes for the future.
You've been listening to Gary Brinzo, Information Coordinator of the National Arbor Day Foundation, located in Nebraska City, Nebraska. And finally, we have our weekly listing of coming attractions, a segment in which we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, and anything else related to history that might interest you. First, explore the history of the 20th century's favorite British royals this week on Arts and Entertainment. Each segment of Biography this week will be devoted to a different royal. For those who missed last night's segment, Diana, the True Story, it will be rebroadcast Wednesday. The two-hour documentary includes interviews from everyone close to Diana, from her hairdresser and speechwriter to her cooking teacher and personal trainer. Tonight, tune in for a personal perspective on Prince Charles. Everybody winding up for the 1998 baseball season should catch the History Channel this Friday for a broadcast devoted to the scandalous 1919 World Series. The show, World Series Fix, the Black Sox Scandal, will explore America's reaction when 8 members of the Chicago White Sox were charged with accepting bribes to throw their games. Check your local listing for more specific information on both of these shows. And if you happen to be passing through the nation's capital this week, there's still time to see the final days of the National Museum of American History's exhibit, Stalking the Elusive Computer Bug, which ends Sunday. For those who wonder why computer errors are called bugs, the display features the corpse of a moth that impeded a computing device in the Harvard Computational Lab in 1947. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have any comments to offer, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.